live from the campus of Concord University in Beckley, West Virginia, the Irma Bird Center. This is another in the continuing series of PRISM West Virginia American History Chats. Now, here are your hosts, Dr. Bill O'Brien and Professor Keith Lilly.
Everyone, here we are at another American History Chat here at the Irma Bird Center. I'm Keith Lilly, and my friend and learned colleague, Dr. Bill O'Brien. We're here to talk about some American history, hopefully, tonight.
Hopefully tonight.
Yeah.
We have quite a few things to deal with.
I know you have a few things to talk about in terms of the founding corps.
Right.
But I had a couple announcements that I wanted to make.
By all means, let's begin there.
Of course, today is the 15th, and this is the due date for Unit 1. A few of our teachers have asked for extensions for various reasons, and I've been fairly liberal on that. And we're not going to tell any of my Concord students that I was as liberal as I've been. But I want you to, get those in as soon as you can, especially as many of you said you'd have it by the end of the week. That would be great. I've already printed out several of them. What I think you and I are going to do in terms of both of these courses is we're going to print out these essays, these papers. We're going to actually write, hopefully, legible comments on them. And I believe we're going to have Margaret mail them back.
Right.
I think that would be more of a personal approach.
It would probably be a lot better for me if Margaret wrote the comments, but because my handwriting is leaves a little bit to be desired.
Yeah.
But I'll try. If I need to type, I'll type.
Right. Well, I think... if you need anything deciphered, you can always call us.
Yeah.
Right? That would not be a problem.
I can usually read about half of what I write.
You mean a couple of years later?
Yeah, no.
Oh, okay.
A couple of minutes later.
See, I'm always being asked, what is this comment? What is this comment? Usually I can pick it out. Occasionally I have problems. So we have that on our plate right now. We also have the research projects for the 19th century course. Many of you still have not given me project topics. What I would like everybody to do is get those in as soon as we can. Some of you had given me a couple of different ideas and said, I either want to do this or that. You need to decide on this or that. You want to start working on that. But, Bill, we have some really exciting topics. Some of our teachers are doing some research in some very interesting ideas, home front during the Civil War, that gets us into all kinds of issues in terms of the nature of war and how governments deal with their populations, etc. Someone's doing work on the origins of War of 1812. We have Jackson's Indian policy. We have all kinds of different things that we can look at. So very pleasing in terms of the people have selected. If we just get those topics in, I think it's going to be advantageous to you, not just to us, but to you as well. So I definitely want to encourage everyone on that. We will have another chat for the 19th century. I believe, what is that, the 29th?
Two weeks from tonight.
Is that the 29th?
Yeah, it's the Tuesday after Thanksgiving.
After Thanksgiving, where we'll all weigh,
And I guess we're kind of waiting to confirm this, but we probably are going to have a new voice here. We're trying to get a new person here to participate in that chat. And I don't know whether that means that we're getting tired of listening to each other or what.
I just kind of vary it up a little bit.
We need to vary it up a little bit.
At some point, I can go ahead and say this, at some point... Dave Bard's already agreed that he would come and participate. So at some point, I plan on making it a point to bring him in. And I know so many of our teachers enjoyed him this past summer. Many of our teachers are his former students. A few of our teachers are my former students.
Right.
So this is, an opportunity.
That's the first sign you're getting old,
Yeah, I have one student right now, and I had her mother. As a student,
I'll tell you,
I guess when they get the grandkids all, you know.
Well, I watch, sometimes in pro football, I watch these young guys, and I remember their dads playing,
yeah,
you know, and
yeah.
it kind of ages you a little bit.
Yeah, Clay, you know. Matthews last night.
Yeah.
Yeah, certainly the case. And so we definitely will have that going in the future. We certainly hope to, at least. I really also, again, would encourage any of the teachers who want to come on and talk about their projects or talk about what they're doing in their classrooms.
Right.
To feel free to contact us. We would love to have you right here with us at the Vernon Bird Center, you know, telling your colleagues, telling teachers not only in southern West Virginia, but telling teachers across the country and really across the world, mm-hmm. Theoretically at least, you know, what's going on in your classroom, how the PRISM project is helping you. We've been getting emails and things like that that have told us a lot of really good stories.
Right.
And so we really like to share some of that with the world.
We have a couple of emails from our current teachers that are both very positive. One of our teachers who was with us apparently believes, at least, you know, there's no way to confirm this, but was a candidate for a position, a full-time position, in one of our counties, and believes that he secured that position in large part because he's participating in this program. One of our other teachers, who happens to be teaching geography, used the DBQ approach and apparently had tremendous results. I've kind of given away a little bit, but later in tonight's program, I want to do a little bit with this DBQ issue and get off history a little bit, get into addressing what's going on in our education system, what's going on in our schools. But I also wanted to tie into your comment about due dates. In the syllabus for the Pillars of Principle, which is the founding course, the due date on the syllabus for the first group of essays, I think it's two essays, is December 2nd, is Friday, December 2nd. And I want to be very, very flexible with that. Mainly what I want the essays before we break for the holidays.
Right.
Because once we come back in January, we're going to be launching into the second unit of the course. And I don't want anybody to get so far into the second unit when they haven't completed the first unit. So I'm really suggesting, encouraging, urging, begging teachers to get these things in before we break for the holidays. I have a December 2nd date. I'm not going to hold anybody to that. If they comes in a week later, 10 days later, I don't care.
Right.
I'm going to read them over the holidays, I hope. But what I don't want you to do is put it off to the point that one part of the course begins to back up on another part.
Right.
Then you're going to get into conflicts with the 19th century course. Then we really have a problem. And I'm trying to avoid that. So I want to be flexible. Please don't get hung up on due dates. The main thing I want is I want you to get it done. These questions, I have copies here. We maybe get into these a little bit this evening because and address a few things about them. But these are what I like to call thought questions or reflective questions. They aren't questions where you go to a particular place to find the answer. These are questions, hopefully, where you will spend time thinking about the questions in light of what you read, what you heard, the presentations that you heard this summer. They're all available on archive, all the presentations from this summer's program, John Kaminsky, Tom Tierney, all of them are available on the Head On Radio Network website in archive. You can relook at any of the presentations that pertain to one of the essays you're doing. These are thought questions. They are reflective questions. And what we are asking you to do is think through the questions, come up with what you believe is a reasonable answer to the questions, and then basically select the information, the primary materials and the secondary materials, the information that you believe backs up your response, your answer to the question. That's really what we're hoping that will happen. And I got to say, well, before I forget it, before we get into something else, that I know Keith was encouraged. I sure as heck was when we went to see Gordon Wood.
Yes, definitely.
We had a number of our teachers there. And first of all, I want to thank you for coming. But I think the evening itself was thanks enough. I think it was a great time. And I think Gordon Wood was great.
Yeah, and the crowd, generally. I mean, there was an excellent turnout for that event.
Yeah, that auditorium was almost full, and the balcony was half full at the Art Center. So it was great at the Culture Center.
And I think a couple of our teachers who actually teach there in Charleston, they were there, and they had some of their own students there. And I had a few of my students there, and so it was a great evening. It was a very thought-provoking lecture as well. I don't know how much you want to get into the content of that.
Well, the applicability of the content connecting the founding with the Civil War, I think, was very, very appropriate. And Ken Sullivan, who was the director of the Humanities Council, who hosted and introduced Gordon Wood that night, told me at the during the reception afterwards that he had mentioned to Gordon Wood the fact that there were a number of people there who were under the Teaching American History Grant program. And when I had Professor Wood sign, I brought two of my books, his books, and asked him to sign them. I did. I mentioned that. You know, I mentioned the PRISM program and the fact that we had a number of our teachers there, and he was very, very complimentary to the Teaching American History Grant program generally and to the reception that he received in Charleston. It was really, really good. And again, what he did was link the ideas of the founding to the circumstances that ultimately produced the Civil War. I thought it was really
very thought-provoking.
Yeah.
And it kind of leads me into something that I kind of wanted to kind of mention. I'm going to have the second unit for the 19th century course. I want to try to put that up in the next couple of weeks. What I really would encourage our teachers to do is give me any suggestions. I mean, if there are a particular subject, particular topic, particular set of documents maybe that you think would be really, really useful, feel free to let me know.
Now, right.
What I'm planning is to use a lot of the documents in terms of the founding of the Confederacy. And, you know, the Gordon Wood's lecture really kind of drove it home to me that I need to do that, because he really brought out this idea that, in a sense, the founders of the Confederacy, the South, could legitimately say that the North had changed, whereas the South had not in various ways. And so we're going to kind of, I think, look at, especially in the next chat or so, look at some of those founding documents, Confederate Constitution.
Right. And I want to look at several documents this evening around the issue of rights, and especially looking at the Declaration. And so before we get into that, is there anything else? Because I know we have a number of folks out there who are not teachers in our program who are, and obviously this conversation about questions and essays and due dates and all of that is not something that interests them that much. So they're looking at the content, and if we're ready to go, we're ready to go.
We've got to remember, anybody has any questions, email Margaret Ramsey at mramsey@concord.edu.
At concord.edu, and she'll get the questions to us. We'll get them on the air for you.
Ramsey, Ramsey. @concord.edu.
And she's sitting at her computer, and she'll receive the questions right away. Keith, we had talked this evening as part of our program this evening that we would gradually get into the material in the period, but a couple of the documents that I had suggested we might look at pertain to education generally, and given the fact that our primary participants are teachers in the public schools. I thought that we might use a couple of these documents as lead-ins, and the one I'm thinking of is the very top one up there, the Academically Adrift piece. Let me tell you where these came from and what my purpose is. I first of all, I was struck. In the latest edition of the New York Review of Books, there is an article that reviews 6 to 8 books that are out there now that have just come out on higher education, on college and university education, not only in the United States, but in Great Britain as well. And they're very, very pertinent. A couple of them are very, very are too focused. They're not, in other words, I'm not criticizing the books, but the issue that they focus on is very, very specific. It's almost an attack on one issue. For example, one of them deals with the whole issue of faculty lounges and the fact that instructors in our colleges and universities are focusing more on themselves and their own lifestyles than they are on education or anything, the big things that cause them to become educators in the first place. But one of the books that's reviewed there is called Academically Adrift. And what I did is I excerpted this review and the review of one of the other books and put it on an overhead so we could look at it briefly tonight. I don't want to spend a whole lot of time on this because it is kind of off the subject, but given the fact that our teachers are in the schools, are teaching our youngsters, it really is relevant in terms of what some of the issues that are happening in higher education today. And I wanted to make folks, our teachers, aware of this, but also our general audience, that this is on the overhead up there, and I'm not going to read the whole thing because I don't want to just read two people. That's not fair. But in this Academically Adrift book, the authors, according to this, paint what the article, the review refers to as a chilling portrait of what the university curriculum has become. And most of the information comes from the performance of 2,322 students on the Collegiate Learning Assessment. The reason I wanted to get into this is because it's so pertinent to what we're doing here in these courses, in these online courses. These 2,322 students took what is called the Collegiate Learning Assessment, which is a standardized test that's administered twice to incoming college freshmen, and then again they take the same test at the end of their second year in college. So in a sense, the purpose of this assessment is to evaluate what it is that these incoming college students are learning during their first 2 years in college. Theoretically, that's when they're taking their general studies, so-called. And the results, as he says in the opening line, are chilling. They point out that this test, fictitious problem or a fictional problem in business and or politics, and to write a memo advising an official on how to respond to it. It's almost like you are a member of Lord North's cabinet.
Exactly.
Critical. You look at what's happening, the primary sources, and your goal is to recommend a strategy to the king. This test asks these college students, 2,322 of them, to look at a series of documents and then basically write a memo in which they advise an official on how to respond to the data. And the result is that this gives a profile as to how much these youngsters have changed, how effective their education has been in the first 2 years. And I'm looking at the second paragraph here. These results are sobering. The College Learning Assessment reveals that some 45% of students in the sample had made effectively no progress in critical thinking, complex reasoning, and writing in their first 2 years in college. And a look at their academic experience helps to explain why. Students reported spending 12 hours a week on average studying, down from 25 hours a week in 1961, and 20 hours a week in 1981. Half the students in the sample had not taken a course that required more than 20 pages of writing in the previous semester. while a third of the students had not even taken a course that required as much as 40 pages a week of reading. I would suggest to you that the bulk of what our students are doing in higher education probably suggests that most of them aren't even doing this. So, but I want to make the case that what we're doing here with the DBQ approach, what we're trying to do is build into the classroom an approach to teaching which addresses some of the issues here that suggest that our colleges and universities are letting us down in terms of what's not happening in the university, in the college classroom today. So that's the first thing I wanted to mention. Then it says that the results also reveal a couple of major things. I'm kind of skimming the third paragraph here. Fourth, fifth line down, it says, still, those majoring in the art and the liberal arts field, the humanities and the social science, natural sciences and math, tended to outperform those who are studying business, communications, and other more practical subjects on this assessment. So in a sense, the students who are majoring in certain areas, the more traditional college areas, tend to do better than the assessment of the others. But that's insignificant in the fact that the results are so abysmal. The second thing, and that's the next paragraph down, Keith, it said, second and more depressing, vast numbers of students come to the university with no particular interest in their courses and no sense of how these might prepare them for careers. The desire they cherish, the authors write, is to, quote, act out scripts of college life depicted in popular movies like Animal House and National Lampoon. Academic studies don't loom large on their mental maps of the university. In other words, the vast majority of these youngsters come to school with no idea of what they want to do, where they want to go, what they want to be. They don't see any relevance at all to their lives in terms of what they're studying. And the results of the test kind
of... More
of
a socialization type situation.
Exactly, exactly. It says, for most of them, in the end, what the university offers is not skills or knowledge, but credentials. A diploma that signals employability and basic work discipline. Those who manage to learn a lot often, though happily not always, come from highly educated families and attend highly selective colleges and universities. They are already members of an economic cultural elite. Our great democratic university system has become a pillar of social stability, a broken community, many of whose members drift through learning little, only to return to the economic and social box that they were born into. The implication here is of this result, the results of this assessment anyway, is that very little upward mobility is happening in our colleges and universities. Those who come from the lower echelon families tend to leave college and go back there because nothing is happening in their education that's changing their lives or their outlook. It points out in the last paragraph here on the first page that in Britain it's a little bit different, and the second line. But for undergraduates, an established system of outside examiners in Great Britain keeps programs across the country honest, ensuring that standards are maintained even if most students are weak, providing opportunities for the ablest at every level of the system. American higher education has no comparable system of assessment, and the opportunities that it provides at every level depend on the generosity and engagement of individuals. Basically, it suggests that in many ways universities have reshaped themselves over the decades to support the current version of students' life. In other words, rather than university become places to which students adjust, in reality, the universities have readjusted themselves to fit the lifestyles and the priorities of the students. So how much change can you possibly expect in a system like that?
Well, let me ask you
this. This is a devastating study.
Well, yeah, it is. And plus, thinking of, you know, in terms of the fact that these students, these college students that we're talking about, are the next generation of teachers, the next generation of lawyers, the next generation of leaders.
Right.
25, 30 years, these are the people who are going to be running the country. And that gets
into the next piece we'll look at.
But let me ask you something, because, I mean, you've taught on the college level for a long time, but in the last several years, you've really been into administration. You're an administrator. I mean, you're the director here for Concord here and at this particular location.
Right.
I mean, there's been all kinds of talk recently, even in our institution, about retention. And that's a word I hear more and more. I mean, do you think that kind of thing fits in here? I mean, retention is a good thing. I'm not saying it's not. But developing, you know, programs and things like that, basically.
Retention is a major problem, and part of it is because our system is not doing a good job in at least making itself appear to be relevant to students. And so students leave because they don't see any purpose. They don't feel like they're going anywhere. We have students that change their major 3, 4, 5 times, and that's not bad if it's done in the right frame of mind. But in a sense, what this kind of suggests is that there's a basic breakdown in people's perception, students' perception, of what the university is doing for them. And the fact of the matter is the university's response has been to try to readjust itself to respond more directly to the wants and the needs of priorities of students, when in fact the students are paying big bucks to come there and get something else, and they're not getting it. I find the last paragraph of this particular review very very telling, because he says in this it's about the last paragraph, is this a crisis? And these authors say, no, it's not a crisis, because students and their parents continue to seek and pay for places at colleges and universities, and government and graduate schools continue to accept their products, and corporations continue to hire them and to spend more than $50 billion a year to train their employees in the skills they need, which they don't come out with from college. But those already born into the wealthy and the professional classes benefit disproportionately from the best educations. Acquire any sort of college education and you'll make more money than you would have if you didn't go. But don't expect that you'll make what you would have made if you studied math at Stanford. I mean, the bottom line is the prestige institutions are maintaining the standards, and they are very demanding of their students, and the students that they turn out are quality students for the most part. But the other institutions that have become dependent on enrollment and retaining students once they get them, they tend to be much more flexible and much less willing to adhere to standards. And the result is that, at least the results of this assessment show, that very, very little is happening to students from the time they come until they retake that test 2 years into their college education. Nothing has happened. And the nature of the assessment, again, is to give them documents and make them apply the information and the knowledge in those documents to a problem. That's exactly what DBQs in the classroom is: introduce students to primary sources, encourage them to make develop their own interpretation, their own argument as to why things in history happened the way they did, and use the information that they discover through research in order to defend their position in writing. We're trying to develop critical thinkers, critical writers, people with research skills, and all of it. That's what's missing here. Mm-hmm. So I thought this particular criticism of higher education is a perfect example of what we're trying to do here in this PRISM program. The second, if you go down just a little bit, the second book reviewed, I'm just going to make a short point here, but the book by William Bowen and his collaborators is called Crossing the Finish Line, and this deals with another issue of a problem in higher education, And I want to speak, because this is a problem that's hit us here in this program, and I wanted to share it with you. Our system fails on another level, even more unequivocally than it does in generating academic engagement. Recent polemics about graduate education, which is what this course is, especially in the humanities, which is what this course is, have cited the high rate of attrition, the number of students who quit, around 50%, as clear evidence of a profound failure. Graduate programs certainly need scrutiny and reform, but their losses are hardly distinctive. Attrition is the American way in education at all levels. We see it here all the time in terms of the numbers of students who feel very comfortable dropping classes. They intentionally take more classes than they're going to finish because they know they're going to drop a couple. Part of the reason, I believe, is because so many of them are using public money to pay for their education. If they were working to pay for their tuition, they'd be much less inclined to drop the courses. The problem is that the cost of tuition has gone up so high that very few jobs pay enough for students to pay their own way, very honestly. And then it points out down here at the bottom with attrition that some of the best public bachelor's degree programs in the country, like the University of Virginia, William & Mary, and Berkeley, graduate 90% of their students. But most colleges and universities, especially public ones, are looking at graduation rates and retention rates in the rate of 35, 40, 45%. So basically, we're losing half of our people. And so obviously, the system is failing those who pay, who come here. Many of them leave after a year or two in debt, and they leave with nothing. And so this is a major challenge for higher education. But basically, this whole issue of attrition, and it's killing us in terms of our competitiveness in this country. Here in West Virginia, it's killing us because our whole economic development future depends on educating our young people not to be as good as those being educated in the rest of the country, but better than they are. And we can't afford to have dropout rates and attrition rates and just kids dropping out of high school without graduating and beginning college and never graduating and beginning graduate classes and leaving at the programs at the rate of 50%. And so while the colleges have a lot to do, so do our students. I mean, basically, we've got a real breakdown here. Keith, the issue that really led me into this, if I can take just a little bit longer, is the Friedman article.
Oh, okay.
The Tom Friedman article. There were two things that this was in yesterday, Sunday's New York Times op-ed page. Many of you will recognize Thomas Friedman as the author of The World is Flat. And if you think about, if you know The World is Flat, you know that when he wrote that book some, 10 years ago now maybe, he predicted that technology was going to equip the rest of the world to become much more competitive with the United States. And we were going to have to go some in order to maintain our superior position in terms of educational quality and in terms of skills and abilities, talents of our graduates. His argument is that as technology made education, made the internet and education more available to more people throughout the world, it was sending a message to the United States that we were going to have to beef up our education system in order to meet this competition. It's very obvious if you look at the studies that are out about the United States education system being 10th, 18th, 25th, it's obvious that we aren't doing the job. And it's obvious from that previous thing we just looked at that our colleges and universities aren't doing the job. So we're beginning to... Tom Friedman predicted this 10 years ago when he wrote The World is Flat. Now he wrote this piece in yesterday's New York Times. And there are two themes I wanted to point out in this article. You can still get it. Just go NewYorkTimes.com on your computer and just look at the op-ed section under Tom Friedman. The title of his article is The Last Person. And he writes it, he is in India. And he says that there's a concept in telecommunications called the last mile, which is when you build a phone system, the most difficult part is to connect the person at the very end, at the end of the line. He's talking to an official of the Institute of Technology in Rajasthan, India, Prem Kalra, who is the director. And Prem Kalra says that his institution, which Friedman says is one of the elite MITs of India, has dedicated his school to overcoming a different challenge, connecting the last person. How will we reach the last person, Kalra asks Friedman during their interview. The last person, Mr. Kalra says, is his view of the poorest person in India. And the question consuming Kalra is, can the financially worst off person in India, 220 million students, the poorest person in India, can the poorest person in India be empowered, be given the basic tools to acquire enough skills to overcome that level of poverty? That's the goal of this institution that Mr. Kalra directs. In a country where 75% of the people live on less than $2 a day, how do you find the poorest person? This is the challenge. India's Human Resource Development Ministry put out a very specific proposal that Kalra and his Technology Institute decided to take up when no one else would. Could someone design and make a stripped-down, iPad-like, internet-enabled, wirelessly connected tablet that the poorest Indian family, saving about $2.50 a month for a year, could afford if the government subsidized the rest? Specifically, could they make a simple tablet usable for distance learning, teaching English and math, or just tracking commodity prices for under $50, including a profit for the manufacturer? The answer was yes. Last month, Kalra's team, led by two IIT Rajasthan electrical engineering professors, one of whom comes from a village that still doesn't even have electricity, unveiled the Akash tablet. Akash is Hindi for sky. It's based on the Android 2.2 operating system with a 7-inch touchscreen. The cost of this is $30. If Indians could only purchase tablets made in the West, the price points would be so high that they'd never spread here, said Kalra. So we had to break the price point. They did it by taking full advantage of today's hyper-connected world, pulling commodity parts mainly from China and South Korea, using open-source software and collaboration tools, and employing the design, manufacturing, assembly abilities of two companies in the West and one in India. The Akash is a ray of hope that India can leverage technology to get more of its 220 million students enough tools to escape poverty and poor teaching. But, Friedman says, it's also a challenge to the West. And I think we saw the challenge in the previous piece that we looked at here. In terms of hope, this is a great story. In terms of hope, Friedman said, I was struck by a story that Kalra's wife, Urmila, told about a chat that she had with their maid after the Akash was unveiled on October 5th. As Urmila recalled, her maid, who who has two young children, said that she had heard, this is a quote, from the night watchman that Mr. Kalra has made a computer that is very cheap, and it's so cheap that even she could afford to buy it. The watchman had given her a picture from the paper, and she asked me if it was true. Ermila told her that it was true, and then the machine was meant for people who could not afford a big computer, added Ermila. She asked, how much will it cost? I said, it'll cost you around 1,500 rupees, $30. She said, 15,000 or 1,500? I said, 1,500. She was sure that if the government was doing something so good for the poor, it had to have a catch. What can you do on it? She asked me. I said, if your daughter goes to school, she can use it to download videos of class lessons, just like she has seen my son download physics lectures every week from MIT. I said, you have seen our son sitting at the computer listening to a teacher who is speaking. That teacher is actually in America. She just kept getting wider and wider-eyed. Then she asked me, will her kids be able to learn English on it? I said, yes, they will definitely be able to learn English, which is the passport for upward mobility here. I said, it will be so cheap that you'll be able to buy one for your son and one for your daughter. That conversation is the sound of history changing, says Friedman. Let me stop for a second. First of all, many of our teachers right now are tuned into this program on iPhones or at their schools because they don't have broadband at home. Every child down to the poorest person in India is going to have a $30 iPad that's internet accessible where they can download movies and music and videos and English learning sessions and lectures and everything else. And we can't get broadband to Summers County or Wyoming County. How many of our kids in the classes we teach live in homes that do not have broadband, do not have internet access?
Yeah, it really struck me. And year after year, when the governor of West Virginia, where there's Manchin before, of course, Tomlin now, continually brings this up, and we talk about it. It seems like every year, accessibility to broadband internet.
And as you know, Verizon got out of the business. Now they're exclusively in wireless. What we do in this society, this is me talking, I'm on a soapbox here, but I can't help it. What we do, what our Verizons and Telos and AT&Ts and Sprints and U.S. Cellulars are doing, we are upgrading the quality and the capabilities of machines for the few who can pay for them, rather than make them available to the people who don't have them. Our kids don't have a chance competing with other kids in this country who have internet broadband access, let alone the competition that they're going to face from China and India and every place else.
I think we have a comment or a question here.
Bill, I just have to mention, because the last paragraph there, what you're describing is manifested there, that line, it's the only way we can catch China. You know, it used to be that people wanted to catch us.
That's right. That's right.
We're an afterthought.
Well, Bob,
now,
that last paragraph is something else, but you're exactly right. What we're talking about here, we're talking to teachers, but we're talking to an audience of people out there that aren't teachers in this program. But the fact of the matter is, this is the world. When he says that this conversation that this woman has with her maid about the availability of a $30 iPad for each of her children is the sound of history changing. And we just looked at a higher education system that is failing miserably. And it's reflected in where we're going and what we're doing. And I would suggest to you that we need to rethink and revamp the whole way we teach. We think that that's what's happening in this prison program, which is why I'm so passionate about it, because I think we're onto something, the beginning of something here. I believe it very firmly. To the last paragraph, because I think the last paragraph says it all, and I want our teachers to pay a special attention to this. That explains why CalRA tells recruiters the opportunity to get an education in order to get a job. Now we're seeing, according to this last paragraph, CalRA tells recruiters for major companies to stay away from his campus. He wants his Indian students to think about inventing their first jobs, not applying for them. We are turning our entire education system towards getting a job.
That ties right into the other article that you read before, or that we looked at before, one of the book reviews, in a sense of the idea that students go to colleges in order to get credentials. And the
exactly.
idea of getting credentials is to get a job.
Well, the reason I want to do the reviews of the college articles is to make that point, that our education system is aimed primarily at credentialing people for the job market. When in reality, what India is doing, they won't let major companies go near their students because they want their students to learn the skills they need to invent their jobs, not apply for jobs that somebody else provides. Excuse me. In West Virginia, and I'm talking just generally because that's where we are, but here in West Virginia, that is our future. The education system, we have got to basically change the way we are teaching and what we're asking from our children. And as Bob pointed out just a moment ago, I want them, this man says, CalRA says, I want them to start companies and to become CEOs of their own. It's the only way we can catch China. It used to be catch the United States. If India is doing this and they're making technology available to the poorest person in India, and they're out to catch China, what does that say about what our challenge is? And what do those reviews of what's happening in higher education say about the way we're meeting that challenge?
Wait, we have a comment here from a listener. We thank you for your comment, and I'll just read it.
Right ahead.
He's talking about the critical task Dr. Bill is mentioning. It was the subject of the email. She says, it's very similar to what students need to be able to do for the GRE test. We only get there when we start teaching to the test at the college level.
Yeah. Yeah. Teaching to the test. And I was talking it into another context. On Tuesday mornings, I teach a class to senior citizens, and we were talking this morning about the situation that occurred this past 2 weeks at Penn State. And we were talking about the issue of humanity. And, you know, I personally am one of those people that believes that part of an education is to teach people what being human means. And we've dropped that out because it's not testable. We've eliminated that from our curriculum. So no longer do people read literature about how people interact and solve their problems. Rather, they read Cliff Notes. And what they're after is the heroine, the villain, the plot, for the standardized test.
The facts.
They take music appreciation classes so that they can basically name a piece of music and who composed it. They take art appreciation class so that they can identify a painting and name the person who painted it. But that's as far as it goes. It never gets into the soul of human beings. And so we're turning out human beings that don't know how to be human. This is an approach to education which addresses that. And the whole idea is you don't basically educate people to get jobs that other people create. You educate people to create their own jobs, to invent the future. I don't want students in my history classes to set a goal of knowing as much history as I do. I want them to know as much history as I do so that they can go beyond what I know and take it to the next level. So our whole education system needs to be rethought. And I think that what we're doing here with primary documents and BBQs and asking students, rather than having them look at a test and memorize information about historical, you know, events and people, they look at primary documents and they basically make their own decisions, draw their own conclusions of what seems to be happening, and then they basically pull together the evidence to argue their case. And what they are doing is they are writing history. They are creating interpretive knowledge. They are basically creating meaning, new knowledge. And that's what education needs to become about, rather than just credentialing people. So I think, first of all, I think Tom Friedman in this article has just hit it right on the head in terms of why we're falling behind China and now India, because their whole approach to education is different than ours. Our approach, think of the next election, the candidates that are running now and are having the whole issue of the campaign is jobs. No, the issue of the campaign is education. The jobs will come if we have the people who have the skills and the insight and the creativity to create those jobs. But ultimately, if we dumb down the educational process to merely communicate what we already know, we can't go anywhere.
Let me ask you something. I mean, you kind of...
We need to get to the content.
I know, but at least strongly inferred something a while ago, and I kind of wanted to really kind of clarify on this. When you mentioned the Penn State situation, you're contending that with this kind of approach, we also can apply education to such things as ethics,
morality,
character education, those kinds of things you can't really test. You can't really teach to the test in that sense. So that's strongly at least what you're implying, right? Not just... critical thinking and things like that.
Those things are what's been taken out of our curriculum at all levels. Because for one thing, it's too dangerous, it's too sensitive, you're liable to be sued, you have to take religion out of the classroom, you can't. So basically what we've done is we've totally ignored the spiritual needs of students. And I don't mean by spiritual needs what church they go to,
right,
or what preacher they listen to. I mean the whole idea of what being human means. Being human means that you develop a certain level of respect for other people, other humans, and you develop a certain respect for life. Not right to life in the way we define it politically today. I'm talking about real respect for life, respect for the environment, respect for those who have gone before us, respect for our senior citizens, respect for children, respect for other human beings around the world. I would suggest that many of the issues, Penn State being the most recent example,
right,
what we are seeing is an expansion of crime against humanity. Basically, what we're turning out is people who don't see the value of human life and the respect that other humans deserve. And it's being reflected in our crime rates, in spousal abuse, in child abuse, in all of these things. And since we've taken God out of the classroom, because the only way to put God in the classroom is go back to what the Puritans had, where everybody belongs to the same religion or you're driven out. If you don't subscribe, you leave. Short of that, if you're going to respect people's private right to believe religiously what they want to believe, the only way to do that is to find another alternative to teach people to be human. Not drop it and say you can't teach people to be human because we've taken God out of the classroom. That's a cop-out. That basically what we need to do is find other ways to teach human beings what humanity is about and what being human is about. Why we're on this earth, what life is about, the way we should look at life, look at respect others and all of these things. you know, and I'd like to believe that the criticisms of Joe Paterno and you know, and Penn State University, I mean, all we hear is this holier-than-thou attitude that, you know, towards this, they should have done this, he should have done that, he shouldn't have been satisfied just to report to the person above him and all of this other stuff. But all the research, all the psychology, that research that's been done indicates that more often than not, most of us are trained to look the other way, to see what we want to see and not see the things we don't want to see. And there are all sorts of research data to back that up. I would like to believe that the vast majority of people in this society would have done more than Joe Paterno did, but the research doesn't suggest that that's true. Most of us would have done as little as he did, or perhaps even less. And all you need to do is think of the examples we hear of people being accosted and abused on the street, an entire neighborhood standing around in a circle watching. And you hear that over and over and over again. All you need to do is hear the number of people who lose their jobs because they blew the whistle on somebody. And you begin to realize that in our society, we have built in so many costs to doing the right thing that most people try to figure out a way not to get involved, not to stop. It's not my business. It's none of my business, et cetera, et cetera. And so, in a sense, I think that what we're creating is you know, and I think our education system is doing it, that we have redefined our education system in such a way that we have not taken into consideration the spiritual needs of our people. And I think it's showing. It's showing in our crime rates. It's showing on Wall Street. It's showing everywhere in terms of what people will do to other people. What we've done is teach them the skills as to how to rationalize it. And for those that can afford it, we have a whole slew of attorneys who are more than willing to be available for so much an hour to help them rationalize behavior that at best is borderline, in terms of what the right thing to do is as opposed to the wrong thing. And so, in a sense, I think that this is it's 10 till 8, so this is a long way
right
to explaining that I think what we're trying to do here is very, very important, because I think that we're doing more than talking about the founders. We are talking about an approach to education that matters. And I think the more you read about the criticisms of education at all levels today, the more I begin to realize that we're on to more here than we think we are.
And hopefully, though, unlike Socrates in Athens, they will not hand us the hemlock.
No.
Because, I mean, Socrates essentially says something, you know, through Plato. Plato, you know, has Socrates saying things that are really kind of similar.
Yeah.
In terms of, you know, the value of education,
right,
you know, at being critical of Athenian right society in similar ways.
Right. So I think this particular article by Tom Friedman, mm-hmm, again, it was in yesterday's New York Times, Sunday the 12th, and I would encourage you to get a copy of this, and I think it's very, very important. With this creative introduction, I wanted to look at some of the documents. Last time we were together in our chats, not the one on the 19th century that you did, but the one before that we did. We were looking at some documents, and the document that I remember, I've heard a lot of response from some of our teachers when we looked at the Massachusetts Liberties in 1641, and I can't, the content, if you remember, that document was very long. We went through it, and it was divided into sections. And what drew me to that document more than any others was John Kaminsky's comment that almost every approach to bills of rights after that, wherever you look, relies on content contained in that document. And the point is, it was in Massachusetts in 1641, that was 11 years after the Pilgrims, the Puritans landed in Boston with John Winthrop as their governor. And many of us, and this was one of the documents that Bob Bliss gave us this past summer, John Winthrop's City on a Hill sermon on the Arbella to the Puritans coming over to Massachusetts in 1630. And it explains the mission that they believed they were on. And the reason that I think the Winthrop document is important is because it lays the groundwork for the context of the Massachusetts Charter of Liberties. In other words, the rights that those people claim in that document are rights that they believe they enjoy thanks to God. They are God-given rights given to that community as God's chosen people. And you can see that perspective revealed in this document. Notice the spelling. You almost have to sound out the words. Winthrop says, "Now the only way to avoid this shipwreck and to provide for our posterity is to follow the counsel of Micah, to do justly, to love mercy, to walk humbly with our God. For this end, we must be knit together in this work as one man. We must entertain each other in brotherly affection. We must be willing to abridge ourselves of our superfluities for the supply of others' necessities. We must uphold a familiar commerce together in all meekness, gentleness, patience, and liberality. We must delight in each other, make others' conditions our own, rejoice together, mourn together, labor and suffer together, always having before our eyes our commission and our community in the work, our community as members of the same body. So shall we keep the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. The Lord will be our God and delight to dwell among us as his own people and will command a blessing upon us if all our ways, so that we shall see much more of his wisdom, power, goodness, and truth than formerly we have been acquainted with. We shall find that the God of Israel is among us when 10 of us shall be able to resist 1,000 of our enemies." I won't go on. But then he goes on and uses the city on a hill idea. "We shall be as a city on the hill. The eyes of all people are upon us." In other words, the way we follow God's plan will become the model for the world to reform itself. This is our mission. This is why God selected us to come to the new world, to set up the ideal community. It's within this context that the Charter of Liberties is issued in 1641. The rights came from God through the General Assembly, which owes accountability to God. Notice that these are not individual rights. They are community rights. God deals with peoples. He deals with entire communities. And the idea is that what God wants us to do is work together, support each other, suffer together, mourn together, laugh together, so that all of us together become one, like one person.
At the same time, though, if that is the approach, it's covenant theology. If there's someone in our midst that doesn't agree with us, if there's someone in our midst that violates this covenant, then we have an obligation to deal with that, or they could be a danger to all of us.
Because if we don't, God will punish the whole community.
Yeah,
we'll be not living up to the covenant. And God will punish us for that. And so that tends to create a society which looks at bad things like droughts and Indian wars and infant infestations and all of these things as God sent. And this causes them to the fire and brimstone sermons. And the whole approach to education, John Cotton, the Boston minister, made the comment one time that students in school are merely empty vessels. And our job is to fill them with truth before the devil has an opportunity to fill them with sin and immorality and untruths.
Fear of witchcraft.
Right. All of this is tied together. But the point is that this is essentially the context of Massachusetts, you know, of the early Puritans in Massachusetts, and the rights that these people claim to have are understandable only within this context. They don't make sense other than that. The Massachusetts Charter of Liberties in and of itself doesn't make sense unless you see it within this context of the city on a hill mission that these people believe they're on. So I think it's a very, very important document. So on these questions that our teachers are answering, if you select the issue of rights, and the first question, I think, deals, this question addresses the issue of human rights, responsibilities, and freedoms. And then it's a long, I've written a long question here, but basically what I'm asking you to do is come to grips with the issue of rights and liberties and deal with these issues because the rights of the colonies are spelled out in the Declaration of Independence. But there's a whole history, there's a background here of where these rights came from and how they evolved and how they changed. And I'm asking you, as part of this reflective question, to think about this and then go where your wisdom and your own brain takes you. In other words, once you decide how to deal with the issue of rights, you'll know where to go. I mean, you know that, you know, there are certain documents you want to go to, certain pieces of writing, secondary sources that you want to go to, in terms of where rights came from. You want to look at John Locke. You want to look at, you want to go back to Tom Tierney's piece and some of the quotes that Tom Tierney shared with us, in terms of rights and the state of nature and all of that. Well, that's not the same thing. This has nothing to do with the state of nature. This is God. These are God-given rights, but there's a difference between, you know, when you get to the Enlightenment in the 18th century, you're dealing with a change, which I think is very significant in terms of individual rights as opposed to community rights, and I think it's a consideration that all of us need to think about. Keith, if you're is there anything that I might
add?
How
would you interpret this Hamilton quote that you use in light of that? I mean, I think it's a very interesting quote.
This is in the question.
Yes,
Hamilton wrote in 1775. He wrote a piece which refuted an earlier piece by somebody who called himself the farmer. And so the title of Hamilton's piece is The Farmer Refuted. And in this, Hamilton deals with the issue of rights. And he says the key issue between mother country and colonies, now this is 1775, this is right before the Declaration of Independence. Hamilton is talking about the key issue between mother country and colonies. And Hamilton says the sacred rights of mankind are not to be rummaged for among old parchments or musty records. He says, they are written as with a sunbeam in the whole volume of human nature by the hand of divinity itself and can never be erased or obscured by mortal power, unquote. So what Hamilton is suggesting is that the whole debate between mother country and colonies about rights, the rights of the colonies, the rights to not be taxed except by your own representatives and all of those things, what Hamilton is saying is the rights go much deeper than the conflict between mother country and colonies. The rights issue goes all the way back to the very beginning. He said these are rights that are written as if they were written by a sunbeam in the whole volume of human nature. In other words, the whole idea of being human, the whole idea of being people, means that you are endowed with these certain rights. They are written as if they were written on you, given to you on a sunbeam. What that means is that they are innate. They are, as Jefferson says in the Declaration of Independence, unalienable rights. They are rights that you are born with, that nobody can take away. And so the implication is, if you believe that, if you believe that England is interfering with rights that don't come from the king or from Parliament, but come from God, then ultimately that makes England the villain. Excuse me.
And I
whole
assume
debate.
That we can understand those rights because the assumption is that this is the Enlightenment here.
Right.
That, you know, man is rational.
Right. Yes. Man has a mind. Man has common sense.
We hold these truths to be self-evident.
Right.
As Jefferson.
Jefferson is writing as an Enlightenment thinker. Mm. And when he says we hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal, he is basically saying educated people throughout the world know that this is true. So basically then his whole perspective is we are not demanding something that we don't have a right to. We are the conservatives here. We're the ones who have the rights that were being violated. We're only protecting ourselves. So to Jefferson, independence is not something we're going for, that we seek. Independence is something that England has forced upon us. And so ultimately, the Declaration is written in the context of an argument, a very clever argument, which lays the burden of responsibility on the mother country rather than on the colonies. The colonies aren't doing anything except protecting rights that Hamilton says come from God. Now, again, these people are making arguments for the world to justify independence. It's not necessarily true that these people as individuals believed what they were saying. You know, that's something else. You know, and many of them, I believe many of them didn't know quite what they believed. But in the circumstances in which Jefferson is writing, this is a very effective argument. You know, it's a very effective case. And this is the Enlightenment. You make your case, you make your argument. That's what we're asking our teachers to do with students, with DBQs, is to do the same kind of thing. But again, this idea of the Puritans being on a mission as a city on a hill, we'll see later on in this program, down the road as we get into the 19th and 20th century, the extent to which American foreign policy is based on the same idea that the United States of America is on a mission to reform the world, that we are the city on a hill.
Didn't we see that in the John Quincy Adams?
John Quincy Adams makes
yes.
that, exactly, yes. Right, in the early 19th century. So, again, in all of this, is part of the covenant theology. All of this comes directly from Scripture. This is God's plan. This is God's world. This is the latest version of the covenant that God created with Abraham that the Jews violated. And now God, because he so loved mankind, he basically selected another chosen people, and that would be us, which the Puritans believe was them when they settled Massachusetts. So if you're going to take the rights question, it seems to me that you really need to get into some of these issues. Now, how you think about them and how you deal with them, that's up to you. But again, to take on that question and not do it with at least some attention to these documents, it seems to me would be faulty analysis. In other words, your essay should reflect that you at least have thought about and considered these things. You can choose, reject, use, don't use, whatever you choose to do. And again, select the question that you take based on your own teaching. Obviously, you don't want to put this kind of effort in reading primary documents and all that into something that you can't use in your teaching. So you want to try to select essays that will have a payback in terms of your own teaching. Keith, let's take a look, if we can, at the Virginia Declaration of Rights in 1775. This becomes part of the Virginia Constitution in 1776 when independence is declared. The Virginia Declaration of Rights is in 1775. May 15, 1776, the Virginia Convention resolved that the delegates, you know, that we become independent. Richard Henry Lee's resolution of June 7, 1776, implemented these resolutions. But this Declaration of Rights was drafted initially by George Mason. If you remember, George Mason does not support the Constitution of the United States because it doesn't have a Bill of Rights. So here is the document, a Declaration of Rights made by the representatives of the good people of Virginia, assembled in full and free convention, which rights do pertain to them and their posterity as the basis and foundation of government. Now notice, this is being written in the context of Virginia being on the verge of declaring independence from the mother country. Section 1, that all men, I guess the reason I think this is important, because there's no question that Jefferson draws directly on George Mason's document for the Declaration of Independence the next year.
May not seem relevant, but let me ask a question. I'm hoping you'll know the answer to this. In other words, this Declaration of Rights, I'm under the impression it is drafted before their first state constitution.
Yes, yes. This Declaration of Rights is before the before the Declaration of Independence.
Yeah, and before the Virginia state constitution.
Yeah, because once the Declaration of Independence is adopted, is approved in July of 1776, then Congress urges the colonies, the former colonies, to write their own constitutions. So this document becomes the model that Jefferson uses.
Is it the tendency of those states, those initial states, to come up with documents like this, bills of rights, before they have state constitutions?
Many of them put the bills of rights into their constitutions. Many of them have separate bills of rights as part of their constitutions. Many of them integrate the rights into their constitutions.
Okay.
But one of the things that's used in 1776 by Madison and some of the Federalists in justifying the Constitution is the fact that some states don't have bills of rights.
Right.
So therefore, the argument that the Constitution shouldn't be approved without a Bill of Rights, Madison points out that many states don't have bills of rights. Why do we need a Bill of Rights on the new federal Constitution? It's a good point. But you can see the similarities between this Virginia Declaration that George Mason writes and what Jefferson ultimately writes in July of 1776, that all men are by nature equally free and independent. The reason I like this, very honestly, is because this puts meat on the bones of the Declaration of Independence. The Declaration becomes kind of a bare-bones version of this. So you can get an idea as to what Jefferson meant in the Declaration by looking at the Virginia Declaration of Rights, because they're much more willing to say what they think in Virginia in 1775 than Jefferson is, because Jefferson's got to get his document through Congress.
Right.
And so, therefore, you're afraid to put anything in it, as we'll see. So, for example, all men are by nature equally free and independent, have certain inherent rights, of which when they enter into a state of society, they cannot by any compact deprive or divest their posterity, namely, the enjoyment of life and liberty with the means of acquiring and possessing property and pursuing and obtaining happiness and safety. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. They are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are the rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That's the scaled-down version of this section number one of the Virginia Declaration of Rights. Section two. That all power is vested in and consequently derived from the people. That magistrates are their trustees and servants and at all times amenable to them. How does this differ from the Massachusetts Charter of Liberties in 1641? In that document, all power is not vested in the people. All power is vested in God as represented by whose interests are represented by the General Assembly, by the legislature. So the people in Massachusetts are not the origin of rights. God is. So in this, power is vested in the people. and magistrates are their trustees and servants and is all time amenable to them. Notice, their elected officials, the magistrates, do not make independent decisions in the name of the people. The magistrates are the trustees and servants and are at all times amenable to the people. They define in this document that representatives do what the people would do if they were there making their own decision. The trustees are merely the magistrates are merely the agents of the people who elect them. They do not make independent decisions. They do not feel the right to define the best interests of the people that they represent.
Fair to say this is arguing that people are sovereign.
Right. Right. And then Section 3, government is or ought to be instituted for the common benefit, protection, and security of the people, nation, or community, and of all the various modes and forms of government that is best, which is capable of producing the greatest degree of happiness and safety, and is most effectually secured against the danger of maladministration, and that when any government shall be found inadequate or contrary to these purposes, a majority of the community hath an indubitable, inalienable, and indefeasible right to reform, alter, or abolish it in such manner as shall be judged most conducive to the public weal. Notice the way in Jefferson's final declaration that's scaled down. And this thing goes on. And you can see that many of these are contained in the Massachusetts Charter of Liberties of 1641. But the origin of the rights is different. And remember, this document is being written to justify the rights of the colonists to stand up against the mother country. It is laying the groundwork by saying this is where rights come from. And once you believe this, if you accept this, then England becomes the villain. And that's the rationale here. And you might scroll down just quickly, Keith, and look at number 4, no men are entitled or exclusive or separate emoluments or privileges from the community, but in consideration of public services. Number 5, that the legislative and executive powers should be separate and distinct. That the number 6, the election of members to serve as representatives of the people in assembly ought to be free, and all men having sufficient evidence of permanent common interest. That's property.
Yeah.
People have to own something before they can vote. Because if they have owned something, they have something to lose, which means they have a vested interest in the outcome. Therefore, they're safe.
Like a stake in society.
Yeah, a stake in society. That all power is suspending laws, and it goes all the way down. I think there were 17 provisions, sections here. They're very quick, and many of them are very familiar. Notice number 13. I'm mentioning this for a reason. That a well-regulated militia or composed of the body of the people trained to arms is the proper, natural, and safe defense of a free state. That standing armies in times of peace should be avoided as dangerous to liberty, and that in all cases the military should be under strict subordination to and governed by the civil power. I'm asking you to think about the Second Amendment on the right to bear arms in the Constitution, the Bill of Rights. The way our Second Amendment is phrased, a well-regulated militia being necessary, the right to bear arms shall not be denied. That's what the Second Amendment says. So obviously the NRA and many groups today talk about this as the right of the individual to have arms. That's what the Constitution, the interpretation of the Constitution today. This is a more elaborate version. And what I'm suggesting here is when you read these earlier versions, you get an idea as to what people were really thinking when the Second Amendment was drafted. And this, the regulated militia, is the key, not the right to bear arms.
They're really the same thing, right?
Yeah, they're the same thing. But today, many of the people, the so-called gun advocates,
right,
choose to ignore the militia part and emphasize the right to bear arms part. And basically what we're seeing here is, at least in 1775 in Virginia, the members of the legislature that approved Mason's Declaration of Right were focusing principally on the well-regulated militia and the dangers of a standing army, not the right to of the individual to bear arms.
Which is something they would not even...
They wouldn't even... Everybody had guns.
Yeah,
everybody had guns.
I mean, you can almost kind of think of it in like a European sense, the idea that only people of the nobility could actually have certain weapons, literally bear arms.
So what we're saying here is that if you put yourself back into the period, if you put this discussion into context of 1775 and 76, we're seeing that many people today are misinterpreting the context of the founders, if you consider this to be a founding document, and I do. And if you go on, I think there are 17 provisions here, and you read them. I mean, you don't want an entire essay to be 16. You don't want the entire essay to be based on this. But the issue of religion, number 16. About people's the obligation that people owe to their Creator, the manner of discharging it can be directed only by reason and conviction, not by force or violence, and therefore all men are equally entitled. Notice, if you read these, you begin to get a context which informs your understanding of the Bill of Rights that we hear interpreted all the time. And I would suggest that many of the screamers on our talk shows today are basically not doing this. They're basically reading into the past what they want. They're reading the present into the past rather than trying to understand essentially the world that the founders came from as they wrote.
Number 16 is very interesting, considering that Virginia, as a colony, course, had an established church.
Yeah. And that's not changed until 1786 with the Statute of Religious Freedom in Virginia.
Right.
And that's Madison and Jefferson.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And then one more document that, and this would be Jefferson's first draft, Keith.
Okay.
If you look at this is from the papers of Jefferson. This is the original draft, Jefferson's first draft of the Declaration, before the committee that he sat on. It was a committee of five that was appointed to draft the Constitution. And Jefferson was given the responsibility of writing it. He had to bring it back to the other four people on his subcommittee, and then they had to bring it back to the full Congress and get it approved. And if you've seen the movie 1776, in there they mention that there were 80-some-odd changes in Jefferson's first draft in the final. So this is Jefferson's first draft. And I've suggested that you look at this and compare it with the final draft. And obviously the big thing that everybody's talking about is that Jefferson has a whole paragraph in his first draft on slavery, which is totally taken out, because the reality is the Southern delegates will not support independence if independence is going to meet an attack on slavery. And so the only way to get the Declaration of Independence is to take out, and John Adams is the one that persuades Jefferson to do this. You know, that right now the issue is independence, not the right and wrongs of slavery. But we'll take care of that later, and you know what happened. But it's very interesting, because here's Jefferson's declaration the way he originally wrote it, second paragraph. Well, first two. When in the course of human events it becomes necessary for people to advance from the subordination in which they have hitherto remained and to assume among the powers of the earth the equal and independent station in which to which the laws of nature and nation's God entitle them, etc. This is very close to the final. We hold these truths to be sacred and undeniable, that all men are created equal and independent, that from that equal creation they derive rights, inherent and inalienable, among which are the preservation of life and liberty and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these ends, governments are instituted among men, and there are some various changes in this, and you can compare the two. But ultimately, Jefferson's version is kind of a scaled-down version of this particular version. One of the things I would like to say before we get off this, and it's 20 after 8 already, can you believe this? But one of the things that I'd like to emphasize is that there's a new book out by Pauline Meyer, well, it's not new, on the drafting of the Declaration of Independence. Mm-hmm. And in that document, she points out that the vast majority of attention in Congress to the Declaration was not on this first part, which is the philosophy, which is what we focus on. Most of the attention was directed at the charges against the king. That was really the focus, was on the details of the allegations against the king to justify independence, not this philosophy. And I guess what I'm saying then is that her position is that Jefferson was right, that these truths were undeniable and generally believed that all men were created equal. They didn't spend any time on this at all. Jefferson was indeed saying what people generally believed at that time. The real focus of attention and the concentration for change came in the specific allegations against the king. The major one being that the king tried to inflame slaves to revolt against their owners, and it became an attack on slavery, and the Southern delegates wanted it out, or they would not support independence. That's the major change.
So they changed it to something vague like right. Servile insurrection.
But notice the idea that nature and nature's God gives these rights to people, not to whole societies, not to communities, but to individuals. And this is the impact of the Enlightenment. This is the impact of Locke and Hobbes and all of those thinkers that Tom Tierney talked about. Anything?
Well, let me ask you this. A couple of summers ago when we had our academy, you did a presentation largely based on one of John Meacham's books about the idea of religion, the impact of the Christian faith,
right,
on the framers. So what I kind of gather from all this is, some of course want to say that Christianity is what inspires the framers. Others point to the Enlightenment. You basically kind of portray it as a combination, in a sense. That with the Puritans, you certainly had this kind of a Calvinist covenant theology.
I believe that people today who see a conflict between Christianity and humanism or the Enlightenment do so because their approach to Christianity is a much more extreme evangelical approach to Christianity than the founders. The founders were Christians. There's no right. question that they were. But their view of Christianity, their view of God, was a lot different than what we hear today from these people that argue that the founders were Christians and they wanted this to be a Christian nation and all the rest of it. Because the founders had a different view of Christianity than many of these folks today have. And they believed, the founders believed, that when they talked about God, they didn't mean the same God that Jerry Falwell believed in, or that Pat Robertson believes in, or any of these folks that are on TV.
Even that John Winthrop believed in.
Right, or that John Winthrop believed in. Exactly. And they believed that one of the things that I, this is my own interpretation, but one of the things that I feel very strongly about is that most of the founders who really studied the subject spent time on this because it bothered them. It really did bother them. And many of them believed that truth was to be learned, was to be studied, was to be discovered, not revealed. In other words, they didn't believe They believed that man's responsibility from God was to find truth, not be told what it is. And so they would be very uncomfortable with this more extreme evangelical approach to Christianity, which defines specifically what a good Christian must believe. They believed, if you read the sermons that these people listen to on Sunday, for example, you would find that these are very thought-provoking, intellectual-type sermons. They aren't, you must believe this and you must do this and fall down on your knees. And they weren't the Jonathan Edwards type of sinner in the hands of an angry God type of fire and brimstone exposés of truth, so to speak. They were provocative questions about Scripture, which were efforts to reason and think through and make sense of what God wanted them to be and what God wanted them to do. And in that sense, they believed that everybody could participate in the search for truth. That was what made this nation possible, was that we could be a nation where everybody was in search of truth, but each person was free to find their own way to it. What scared them was the idea that certain people claimed that they already had it, and all they had to do was share it or give it to other people. And this was the whole idea of conversions and, you know, converting people and distributing Bibles around the world to third world countries and all this other stuff. In other words, they most of them would be very, very suspicious about this.
A lot of things you associate with the Second Great Awakening in the 19th century.
In the 19th yeah. century, yeah, that kind of, you know. And so, you know, most of the, you know, so I believe that Meacham argues in his book that that these people believed in a, you know, I guess you could almost call it non-denominational Christianity or popular Christianity. In other words, a Christianity that was so vague and so general that everybody could subscribe to it. And that's the kind of Christian they were. They were Christians who believed that man's job on this earth was to seek truth. But to be very honest with you, it's the seeking of truth that made it possible for religious freedom to work. That, you know, that's why they were opposed. That's why Madison and Jefferson in Virginia opposed an established church, the Church of England, in the Episcopal Church in Virginia. Because their argument is if people were required to pay taxes to support a particular church, that made freedom of religion something less than it really was. It bastardized the idea of religious
that's
freedom.
That's toleration. But
right.
it's not freedom.
Exactly. It's not freedom. And so, in reality, that's what they were for. So, yes, they were Christians, but they were a very different kind of Christian than we hear in the debates today.
So what happens today, you're saying, is, for example, many of these documents would use the word God. It's not really important how we would interpret the word God, but how they would interpret the word
right.
God.
And that's why if you get in, you find that, you know, for example, I mean, how many times have I talked, I've seen articles and books which talk about the idea of Washington being a Christian, you know, that he was a Christian. Well, you know, and I mean, this is just something I happen to know because I researched the area, but Washington was chair of the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia in summer of 1787. And the record shows that Washington attended church three times during the summer of 1787. The first time, he went to the Roman Catholic Church. You know, so
right.
Christian, yes. But, you know, and you can read all of his papers and all that stuff. He doesn't talk about God at all. It's very obvious that he believes in a God, but he's not comfortable enough knowing exactly how to define that God. So he doesn't talk about it. He's not prescriptive in his conversation because he doesn't feel competent to tell other people what God is and what God wants and all that. He's not. It's not that he doesn't believe in God and that he's not Christian, but he's a truth-seeking Christian that hasn't found the answer yet. And he's looking. And I personally respect that, but that's just me.
It's kind of like Franklin, you know, giving money to all the churches in Philadelphia because he thought that they did good things.
Right.
That's what he was concerned about, not their doctrinal differences.
Before we get off this, can I make just one point? This is not pertinent to this first unit, okay, of the course, but I think it falls into place. If you look at the Declaration, at Jefferson's Declaration of Independence, and the whole issue of inalienable rights, this is his first draft, and then, of course, we have the final draft. One of the documents that I wanted you to take a quick look at is the French Declaration of Rights of 1789.
To man and citizen.
This is the French. This is the beginning of the French Revolution. This is in 1789, after the Constitution of the United States is written. After we have drafted our Constitution without a Bill of Rights, and then, as you know, a Bill of Rights is added when the first Congress gets together, thanks to the efforts of Madison. So this is written in France, after the overthrow of the king of France at the beginning of the French Revolution in 1789. I wanted to look at this. The representatives of the French people organized as a national assembly, believing that the ignorance, neglect, or contempt of the rights of man are the sole cause of public calamities and of the corruption of governments, have determined to set forth in a solemn declaration the natural, unalienable, and sacred rights of man, in order that this declaration, being constantly before all the members of the social body, shall remind them continually of their rights and duties, in order that the acts of the legislative power, as well as those of the executive, may be compared at any moment with the objects and purposes of all political institutions. Men are born and remain, first article, men are born and remain free and equal in rights. Social distinctions may be founded only upon the general good. The principle, the point I want to make is, notice the Bill of Rights, the French Declaration of Rights of 1789. It contains the same statement as the Declaration of Independence contains in 1776, that men are born with certain unalienable rights, that among these are the rights to, et cetera, and they define them. Now, quickly, Keith, if you will, one of the documents on there, I think, is our Bill of Rights, which Congress adopts in 1791. This is our Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments to the Constitution. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Second Amendment, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Amendment 3, Amendment 4, Amendment 5. What's the difference between our Bill of Rights in 1791 and the Declaration of Independence as drafted by Jefferson, or the Declaration of the Rights of Man drafted in France in 1789, or the Massachusetts Charter of Liberties drafted in 1641? What's the difference? I would suggest that the difference is that our Bill of Rights is devoid of any mention of unalienable rights. There's no mention here of God-given rights. There's no mention of God. There's no mention of a creator. There's no mention of nature's God. There's no mention of inalienable rights to rights, liberty, and life, liberty, and property. Merely what our Bill of Rights does is list a series of rights that will not be infringed upon by government, by the federal government.
So it's really more of a list of limits on the power of government.
It basically is the word that the attorneys use all the time is the difference between procedural rights and substantive rights. There's no substantive statement in our Constitution or our Bill of Rights that speaks to people's rights as humans. The only thing our Bill of Rights does is grant procedural rights to individuals in this society as citizens. In this society, people will be secure in their persons, housing, papers, and effects. In this society, no soldier in a time of peace will be quartered in any house. In this society, the right of the people to bear arms shall not be infringed. In this society, Congress will never make a law respecting the establishment of a religion or prohibiting people's free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or press or whatever. In other words, our rights are procedural. And basically, they are written for attorneys and courts of law. They are not written as statements of what human beings have a right to from God. They are. Our Bill of Rights is substantially different from what the rest of the world is still claiming, what Jefferson claimed in 76, that men, because they are men, are entitled to certain inalienable rights that can't be taken away from. They are superior to government. They are superior to you know, that they are theirs from nature, and nature is God. In this society, our Bill of Rights has no such statement, has no such declaration. The implication is that our rights are procedural rights granted to us by government. Wow. That's incredible. And people don't know this. People get the Declaration and the Constitution confused all the time. This is proof positive that there's a difference, a major difference.
Which is the point Joseph Ellis makes in his book, Founding Brothers. We have a comment here.
Yeah, please do.
From Cassie. I appreciate your listening. Not one of our teachers either. In fact, apparently she's a college student. I'm not quite sure where. But she says, say it again. Princeton. Okay, excellent. She says she wants to know, Dr. O'Brien, do you know Dr. Erica Kiss? Are you familiar with her? She taught my Human Values freshman seminar, and we talked a lot about the rights of the founder solvers, the rights that England wanted supported aloud. Right now I have Dr. Philip Petit, who also teaches about similar topics, but more in general and less specifically to the United States. And she says, it is so cool that this is on the horn. Wow. And so she's a student at Princeton who's listening to us and gleaning something from this discussion.
I take it that it's not Princeton, West Virginia.
No, Princeton University.
I don't know Dr. Kiss at Princeton. I know Dr. Robert George, who's the head of the James Madison Institute at Princeton.
Yeah.
And many of the people there. And Carson Holloway was a fellow there at the Madison Institute at Princeton.
Who was one of our presenters this past summer.
Right, was one of our presenters. In fact, his presentation is available on the archived presentations of the
Horn. On Lincoln and the Founders.
Right. One more thing that I wanted. So if you take rights, if you take the essay on rights, obviously, I hope these chats will be helpful to you. There's an awful lot of thought to think about here. The second question, and I just wanted to go through these quickly, Keith, because you know we are getting out of time, and these essays are kind of due. But the second question on our we're asking our teachers to address, and these are choices, is John Adams' statement that the Revolution was effected before the war started. The revolution was in the minds and hearts of the people, a change in their religious sentiments, their duties and obligations. This radical change in principles, opinions, sentiments, and affections of the people was the real American Revolution. So in other words, if you believe that the real American Revolution happened before the Declaration was merely the defining statement that defined what had already happened, which is what Adams said. People's religious sentiments had changed. Many things had already changed. Then to get your information there, you obviously want to look at Gordon Wood's book.
Excellent. Yeah.
On the radicalism of the American Revolution, because he talks about colonial society. So did Bob Bliss. Bliss's presentation, along with Gordon Wood's first units, the first several chapters in Gordon Wood's book, talk about colonial society and the way it was organized and how people believed and how they behaved and what they thought to be true. Now, a change occurred, and that's his second unit, Gordon Wood's second unit. And if you look at that change, then much of your support, if you agree with Adams, is to be found there. But it's not just your opinion whether Adams is right or Adams is wrong. There's got to be substantive reasons why you believe that Adams is right or Adams is wrong. For example, one of the books I wanted to share with you, in fact, I want to encourage you to get John Fiske's book free on Amazon. Use your Kindles.
Yeah. I could put a link to that on Blackboard.
All right. Why don't you do that? Yeah. But I did it this weekend, and honest to God, if I can do it, anybody can do it. Mm-hmm. If you go to your Kindles and you go to the menu, just type in Kindle Store, and it'll give you the books that are available on Kindles for downloading on your Kindle. And all you do is look at history, then American history, then Constitution and the Founders, and look at the book called John Fiske, The Critical Period. And what you will find is it's available on Kindle. It is absolutely free. And I downloaded it Sunday. It takes 1 minute to put it on your Kindle. Read the first two chapters of John Fiske's book. And what you will find is that in the first chapter, he gives you a background of what's going on in England and British politics, which suggests that the American independence was a convenience for the nations of Europe. It was not an objective that the nations of Europe. In other words, England was trying to play France and Spain off against each other and using American independence as a pawn and vice versa. Fiske, through British politics at this time, shows how George III is able to play off one faction within the British government against the other. That's the first chapter. The second chapter points out that Fiske makes the point that the American Revolution was the most conservative revolution in the history of man, that other than not being colonies anymore, nothing changed. So he's basically saying that John Adams is wrong. Fiske's second chapter contradicts what Adams is saying, that the real revolution happened before. Fiske argues that the revolution, except for the Declaration of Independence, was no change at all.
So he sees the Constitution essentially as like a Thermidorian reaction.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes.
You can find Fiske on Gutenberg.org, Project Gutenberg, and you can download it on your Kindle or without images.
All right. And if you look at the table of contents, and let me tell you, if you look at the table of contents to John Fiske's book, the table of contents is about 19 pages long. It is an outline, page by page, of everything that's in the book. If you read the table of contents, you've read the book. And it's the most detailed table of contents I've ever seen. And so everything you would want to know, you can pick up in the table of contents, and you'll have that on your Kindle. And but the point is that if you're taking the Adams question about the revolution was affected before the war started, then it seems to me you got to take on Fiske, who says that's not true. And then you have to look at what Gordon Wood points out to point out that, yeah, it is true, that many the kinds of changes that happened were revolutionary. Gordon Wood says that the American Revolution, the radicalism of the American Revolution, is the title of his book. So he believes that the American Revolution was really radical change. Fiske argues it wasn't. So by being able to get Fiske, you can basically wrestle with that question and have the arguments on both sides.
Now, Fiske is a much older book.
Yeah, Fiske was written
in 1880s.
1888. So Fiske's book was written more than a century ago. The third question deals with Lord North's ministry. you are a member of his, and he asks you what to do. We've talked about that already. Look at the nature of the empire, how the colonies were managed. By all means, look at Fisk's first chapter,
definitely,
because he goes through the whole of British politics and points out that American independence was just a pawn in this whole major power struggle between the nations of Europe. And if it hadn't been for the expertise of Franklin, and also Fisk supports, gives a lot of credit to John Jay and John Adams as well, and said if it hadn't been for the expertise of our diplomats, we never would have been independent at all.
It's classic traditional diplomatic history.
Yeah. So if you're taking the Lord North's question, you want to look that way, obviously look at the website, the collection of letters between Lord North and George III.
Archive.org.
You'll find those. That's the third question. And then the last question asks you to look at the conflict between England's colonies and the mother country, 1763 to 76, from the perspective of republicanism, and that's what Gordon Wood's book is about. So in Gordon Wood's first two units, you could get the answers to two of these essay questions right there. And Fisk deals with one of the questions in his first chapter and one of the questions in his second chapter. And then if you deal with the issue of rights, you obviously want to deal with some of the primary documents we've looked at as well. So I think you know where to go and what to look at. And again, these questions are intended. I told somebody, one of you, one of our teachers today in an email, these are intended to be thought questions. What I want you to do is reflect on what you've read, reflect on the questions, and basically in your mind organize your essays and say, this is the way I would argue. This is what I believe the answer to that question is. And the reason is, and then follow Phil Roden's model for writing a good essay. And this is my argument. These are the facts I need to back up my argument. This is my hook, you know, and basically put together your argument to defend your point of view on the question. You can't miss with this. I want to emphasize that. So, again, what you want to do is make sure that you select the questions that are going to have the biggest payoff for you in your teaching. Keith, anything?
I tell you, your third question would make an ideal DBQ. The one about Lord North. I mean, you could come up with, you know, come up with a question. You know, they could come up with a question for their students based on that. How are you going to advise Lord North? That is tailor-made for something like what Bill Roden's doing.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
see, the
put
documents,
yourself in that place.
The Virginia charters that I put in there, there are four of them, and I mentioned them in the syllabus. And I don't care about the document. I don't care about the details of the document. But what they become is kind of an indication as to what England thought was necessary in order to manage an overseas empire. And then a couple of years later, they come up with a new charter, which suggests that we need to fix some of the things that we didn't deal with in the old charter. And so what you're beginning to see is England's getting an education. From the first one to the second one to the third one to the fourth one, England's getting an education in how to manage an empire that's 3,000 miles away. And, of course, she never really quite figures it out. Then you take that and you combine it with the politics that John Fisk talks about.
And you know why they didn't figure it out.
And then you begin to understand why England couldn't manage the colonies and why the colonies were allowed to get totally out of hand. And that's when they come up with all these things about independent rights and unalienable rights and all of this stuff. And the colonies, Jefferson is able to make the case to the world that we deserve to be independent.
I would point out David McCulloch's book, 1776, has a pretty good discussion about Lord North for that question as well. And he, you know, it's a nice little narrative history. And obviously there's a little section in there about British politics that might would be useful if it's in any of your local libraries or anything of that.
And I think if you go on books on C-SPAN,
okay.
I think there's an interview with David McCulloch on there on 1776, and a lot of that's probably in there as well.
Oh, excellent. Good deal.
So again, you know, all we want you to do is have a well bow. By the time you get through, if your students ask you anything about the issue of rights and freedoms and all of this stuff, you'll know so much more. That's really the point. I mean, I think if you allow yourself to get back into the period where these people lived, you can begin to understand there's much more. That's what bothers me, is what our politicians today are doing to the founders and doing to these values and these principles. These are really meaty subjects these people think about. These people really believe this stuff. And they argued and they debated and they wrote articles in the newspaper back and forth, making their points of view. That's one reason why one of the things in the First Amendment in the Bill of Rights is the freedom of speech. You, in this kind of a society, which is based on the idea of pursuing truth, you sure as heck can't deny people access to the press, a free press, or free speech, or any of these other things. You just can't.
Is that why Madison and Jefferson reacted so violently to the Sedition Act?
Yeah. Yeah, because it violated all the freedoms that were necessary in our society. Before we end, and we're like 9 minutes away, I just wanted to make one point, and this is kind of a transition into the second unit of this course. And this is probably not applicable to the essays that our teachers are writing, but I think people tuned in, whether they're teachers in the program or not, would be interested in this. The one theme that has driven, dominated everything we've talked about so far is that everything we've talked about so far has been from the perspective of the empire. In other words, all we've talked about so far are mother country and colonies, the rights of the mother country to manage the colonies, the rights of the colonies to be taxed by only their own representatives, the rights of the colonies not to have unalienable rights infringed upon. And Jefferson lists in the Declaration all of the things that the king has done to violate the rights that people have a right to. We hold these truths to be self-evident. In other words, this is what people all over the world know to be true. These are the rights we're supposed to have. Look what the king did to us. And that's his case. That's Jefferson's essay on the right to the colony, of the colonies. But every one of these issues that we've dealt with is from the perspective of the empire. In other words, everything that we've talked about tends to assume that the story behind American independence lies between the relationship between mother country and colonies. We've done almost nothing to talk about what's happening in individual colonies. Why is it that some people in the colonies wanted independence and some people were petrified by the thought of independence? I'm thinking of Joseph Galloway, right, and James Wilson and many of the so-called nationalists during the period. And what I'm suggesting is there's a whole different approach to independence than what we've done so far, and it's what many historians refer to as the internal approach, looking at what was going on within the colonies themselves that made independence an option for some people and independence something to be dreaded for other people. And that's kind of the second unit of this course, which will be the Confederation period. I think you've got a question or comment.
Actually, a comment from Carolyn Webb, who's one of our teachers, and she wants you to know that you've given her a much better understanding of what the founders meant by rights, and that this has been her favorite program so far. And
oh,
she
great.
Wanted to make sure that you knew that.
I appreciate that. Thank you. Thank you, Carolyn. Again, it's complicated. We're asking a lot. I mean, this is complicated stuff. The thing I found the email from Princeton University kind of reinforcing.
Right.
I mean, we're not playing around. This is deep stuff. We're asking a lot of our teachers. We're asking a lot of our listeners, because I really believe this. I mean, this is my period, and I really believe that so much of what we're about as a people and as a nation, we can really begin to understand in this period, because they wrestled with it, they sweated over it, they fought over it, and we're going to see that that these values and these ideals and principles that these guys talked about, and I use guys advisedly because that's indeed what we're talking about, and I know Abigail Adams and some of the others, but the point I'm trying to make is that these principles and these values, as Gordon Wood pointed out, don't die with independence. That these things inform the government we set up, the specifics of how we set up that government, how we create it, how we want it to function, who should be able to participate in it, who shouldn't be able to participate in it. Ultimately, it seems to many people the idea that it's just a matter of time before the issue of slavery has to be dealt with one way or the other, because it violates everything that these people said independence was about.
I think we have a comment here. Go ahead.
Dr. Bill, just if you would please comment on, okay, here's the question. What does it do to us as a nation when the number two book on the New York Times bestseller list is an alleged history of the assassination of Lincoln, and the book is rife with inaccuracies and outright falsehoods?
Right. That you're talking about about Bill O'Reilly's book.
Yes.
Am I not wrong? Am I not right that the National Park Service, the people that manage Ford's Theater, refused to sell that book on site in Washington?
Well, because they refused to sell it in the basement bookstore, but now they've decided that they will sell it in the gift shop.
Okay.
Because people need now, and see, this is the thing that drove me crazy. It's a book of alleged history, and the reason for selling it in the gift shop is to let people decide for themselves. So historical fact is now merely...
Right, a matter of opinion.
Right.
And the point is, it's full of errors. And many people have pointed out many of those errors. And so the fact that people, you know, if you put it in the gift shop and let people decide for themselves, do people have the right to decide whether things that aren't true are history?
Is are history? People entitled to their own facts?
No. People are entitled to opinion, but they are not entitled to the facts. The facts are the facts.
Your point is it's not being sold as fiction. It's being sold as history.
It's being sold as history, but it is bad history.
It's non-history.
And what we're seeing is that people are willing to accept this. And how many times do we hear people say, I know that people say this, and facts suggest something, but it doesn't. What's the phrase you use?
It doesn't fit my values or my belief system.
It's not consistent with my belief system. I don't know how else to say it, but when your belief system is contrary to the evidence, the hell with your belief system. It's wrong. You know, if the evidence is there, you can't refute the facts. If they are facts, they aren't a matter of I'm going to use these or I'm going to take these seriously or I'm not going to take these. If you're writing good history, and that's what we're talking about, if you go back into the period when these people actually wrote, we talked about rights earlier, it's very obvious that these people believe certain things. And as they refined, when we look at our documents like the Declaration of Independence, it's a very scaled-down, refined version of what people believed as they led up to that. And if you read the context within which the Declaration came into being, Jefferson wrote it, you begin to see that what Jefferson is writing is the product of things that he had read and talked about and discussed before that. So ultimately, it's a synthesis of what he believed to be true and what he believed that people at the time believed to be true. And so if you read, for example, George Mason's Declaration of Rights in Virginia, you get a much more detailed view of what they believed in about the right to bear arms and the right of and militia rights and all of these other things. You begin to see what they really believed about God and nature and nature's God and inalienable rights and the whole issue of where property belonged in this and the whole idea of the stake in society that you mentioned earlier. The only people that could be allowed to vote are the people that own something because they were the only ones that had a vested interest in the outcome. They were the only ones that could be trusted because they had something to lose. They weren't risk takers.
Well, there's a difference between that, between history, doing history in that sense, and basically using the past as propaganda.
Yeah.
And liberals are not, you know, I mean, conservatives are not alone in this. Liberals do it as well. I mean, it can be done in all areas of the spectrum.
Hey, listen, I agree.
You know, I mean, Howard Zinn, in a sense, did it. Just as much as William Bennett does it.
And Howard Zinn's argument was, the other side does it, so I'm going to do it back to them.
Well. Yeah.
And basically his assumption is you read both arguments and you'll bring them together and synthesize them and the truth will,
in the middle
will come out somewhere.
Right.
But the fact of the matter is that's, and I think we mentioned that at the beginning of this whole program. You know, you can't presume that you deal with inaccuracy and extreme statements on one side by extreme statements on the other side, and then you're leaving it up to the people. Because basically what we're suggesting, what our education system suggests, is that our people are not being given the tools to make these kinds of judgments and decisions. We are really doing a disservice to our youngsters in terms of the way we are educating, because we're not giving them the opportunity to wrestle with the issues that really matter. And it's the lack of wrestling with those issues, I believe, that is redefining education. Education is becoming more and more the process of credentialing people to get jobs. And even business is saying, we have to spend $50 billion to train these people because they don't know anything when we get them. Well, the reason they don't know anything is because we've become so afraid of being sued by dealing with these kinds of real substantive issues on humanity and spirit and people's religious beliefs. It's not a question of teaching religion. It's a question of recognizing that people are, in large part, what they believe. And to ignore that means you were ignoring what really makes people tick. How can you write history when you refuse to even think about what makes them tick as people and what their priorities are and how they view the world and how they view their own role in it, how they view their responsibilities as a parent, as a husband, as a wife, as a father and a mother, as a citizen, as a public servant. Gordon Wood talks about that in his book about public servants, that they didn't believe that these people who ran for elective office ought to be paid. That would bastardize the whole process. The argument was that you needed to take people that had nothing personally to gain from it, and they were the ones that needed the opportunity to give back, and that was their responsibility as successful people in society, to basically take the opportunity to give something back. If you saw 60 Minutes this past Sunday night about these members of Congress that are dealing in health, in medical stocks and all of these things during the healthcare debate, they're taking advantage of their insider positions to make money. The founders would go crazy if they saw 60 Minutes Sunday night.
Even Hamilton?
Well, Hamilton would love.
He might like it.
He would like that. Yeah. But anyway,
I think we're out of time. Right?
I think we went over, Bob. You know.
But it's
anyway.
It's okay.
I had to cut the stream.
Okay.
Oh, okay.
But anyway, I really believe, you know, so strongly that you're right. That question about Bill O'Reilly's book. I mean, it's unbelievable.
Well, Bill, what you're going to love even more is the fact that he is now contractually obligated to produce at least two more books, one of them an in-depth study of an as-yet-to-be-named president. Uh-huh. Care to guess? I mean, he won't make the safe choice. You know, Millard Fillmore,
no.
Martin
FDR.
Van Buren.
FDR.
I said FDR last night.
Uh-huh. FDR.
Communist.
Yeah, that's going to be the argument.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. My God. And he can get, I mean, he can basically get what he needs out of Bill Bennett's two-volume History of the United States. You know?
Yeah. The other possibility, Teddy, I'd put my back bet on Teddy Roosevelt.
Theodore Roosevelt or Woodrow Wilson, maybe one of the progressive presidents.
Yeah.
You know, I guess where we've been tonight, Bob, is I really believe that there's so much here that we're not sharing with people. I mean, how the heck can people be intelligent citizens acting intelligently in a society when they don't know any of this? And the people who inform them don't know it either and don't care to know it. And even if they know it, if it doesn't agree with what they believe in, they ignore it. Yeah.
That's because the engineers were not deemed, it was not deemed necessary that the engineers have any functional understanding of the culture in which they operated, because their world was one that was quantifiable by measurements and by calculation. And I remember thinking, you know, what a pathetic way to view a life. In order to make any exterior manifestation have some level of value. Mm-hmm. And these guys didn't. And couldn't string a sentence together.
Yeah.
And that's not me being some sort of elitist snob.
No.
They couldn't.
I mean, I really think that this stuff is so important to think about and reflect upon. And that's what I mean, the first document we looked at, which was the criticism of higher education, we're not allowing people to reflect on anything. Our whole education system is a series of right answers that people are supposed to memorize and master.
And then forget the next week.
God almighty.
And there's this assumption that people are only their
jobs. Yeah.
Weekends and writes poetry in iambic pentameter.
Yeah.
I'd like to have a banker with a passion for geology.
Yeah.
And this used to be that country.
Yeah.
It has not always been this way. This used to be that country, but there, and it's the commercial. It's the commercialization of education. It is the profitization of education, and the idea that education's only purpose is to create little profit makers.
You know, the thinking, and you hear this all the time, is that probably nobody in the Western world got into the psyche, into the heads of human animals better than Shakespeare. And you can learn so much about human nature and interactions among people and motives and intent and all of these things by reading Shakespeare. And you can graduate from many colleges, including Concord,
and not read
Shakespeare. Never read it. And I mentioned it in an email.
Oh, be careful.
I need to be careful.
Yeah.
I mentioned it in an email to an administrator at Concord, and the response I got back is, well, the presumption is that people will have read Shakespeare before they come to Concord.
Or the classics generally.
And if they didn't, there's always Cliff Notes.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, my God, please. I haven't responded because I really don't know what to respond without making that person mad, you know.
Well, you know, if you got your Romeo and Juliet in ninth grade, you know you're done with Shakespeare.
Yeah. But
it's very discouraging, though, to have a class of freshman college students mention Homer, and if they're not thinking of Homer Simpson, it's the first time they've ever heard of it.
So. Bob, thank you.
Thank you very much. Oh, no problem. Hopefully everybody will have a good Thanksgiving. I want to make sure that's the case.
Indeed. That's good night.
That's good, good night, I guess, yeah.
All right. You have been listening and viewing live another in the continuing series of Prism West Virginia American History Chats live from the campus of Concord University Beckley at the Irma Bird Higher Education Center. Your hosts have been Dr. Bill O'Brien and Professor Keith Lilly. Join us again on November the 29th as the chat series continues. This is The Horn.